Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 6th of October 2018. Falling a bit behind here, guys, as I'm doing a bit of programming to get things up and running, but I think it's all is well. This is a really interesting article, and I'm sort of now realising to do the quizzes, I have to really type out the questions and answers and probably publish them as well along with the quiz. Okay, squid and octopuses can't see in colour, and they've got colour. So how do they pull off their kaleidoscopic disguises? Hayley Bennett investigates. Very interesting, you know, how they actually disguise. That's really interesting. I'd be really interested in this article. 20 metres underwater off the coast of northwest Spain, biologist Roger Halton is stalking his prey. His camera is trained on the subject that has painted itself beige, grey and white to match the gravelly seabed. It perambulates towards a clump of kelp, setting itself amid the fronds, quickly deepening its complexion to match the rich green-brown. Colour craft is impressive, but Hamilton, it's also baffling. He knows the common octopus is colourblind. At least this is what the textbooks tell us. His own recent book, Halton lists multiple arguments that cephalopods, octopuses, squids, cuttlefish, see in monochrome. Yet, if you ask him casually, he remains unconvinced. I tend to think that cephalopods are able to sense and match colours somehow. Quite how they do it has confounded biologists for more than a century, though they have come up with some strange ideas to explain the conundrum. Now, we are whittling down the spectrum of possibilities. What's that beautiful spectrum of possibilities? In the hope of getting an unprecedented insight into these most alien creatures seed the world. Like Hamilton, the Nobel Prize winning... Now, isn't that a beautiful, beautiful craft thing? It's almost like you almost teach a machine to write that way. You get a topic and then you flavour your adjectives to that. So, Nobel Prize zoologist Carla von Frisch didn't believe cephalopods were colourblind. In the 1910s, he and ophthalmologist Carl von Hess got into a debate about it. Hess tested the vision of squid cuttlefish by trapping the animals in tanks so small they could barely move and flash coloured lights at them. He noted how their pupils responded to lights and if they tried unsuccessfully to swim away. Their reactions include mirrored patterns seen when people who are colourblind are shown coloured lights. Fish dislike such unnatural test conditions. He had already done experiments training minnows to expect food when they were shown a yellow card, and set out a letter how he planned to train cephalopods to expect foods from a red test tube. Results never surfaced. Debate rumbled on. Zoologist Alfred Kuhn showed that if he kept hitting the octopus with a stick after flashing a coloured light, the animal learned to treat the colour as a warning to swim away. They do see colours, he concluded, but in the 1970s, John Messenger, now based at the University of Cambridge, got the opposite result. He trained octopuses to attack coloured plastic rectangles for reward of sardines. They knew black from white, but could not differentiate yellow from grey cards or equal brightness. Okay. I'm just going to stop here because it is intensely interesting. On the site here there's a little side thing called the skin's mystery sense. Molecules in our eyes, rods and cones that respond to lights and help us see are called opacins. So that's something I'll put in my memory ring. Over the past few years we've found these proteins cropping up in all sorts of places other than the eyes, which makes you wonder, what are they doing there? Like tapir fish, the fins which take on a red hue in spawning season, in a 2015 a study of researchers by Queen's University in Canada showed that opacins in their skin seem to respond to the seasonal changes in colour of the light. Ultraviolet light tickles opacins, which turn prompts pigments in the skin to clump together, changing the colour. In other animals, opacins outside the eye probably play a role in setting circadian rhythms. it's a day-night rhythm. But in the cases of mantis shrimp, it's stranger. One species has opercins in the light-detecting organ attached to its brain. The shrimp has no eyes. The shrimp has no eyes and may poke its organ out of its burrow to sense danger. Wow. Since 1990s, we have shown that opercins are spread around the mammal brains, including our own. 2015, Elena Oencia at Brown University at Rhode Island was part of a team that discovered that we also have opercins in our skins, just as squids do. What they do there is far from clear. Especially unpleasant research has found that at least one of the molecules has a chemical tweak that would mean it doesn't in fact respond to light. We are very excited to find them, and I would have predicted that people for years we would have figured out what they do, said Oceana, but we don't know. So opercins, I'm going to see if I can see what the molecule is, whether it's got, you know, it's got cyclical or long, you know, double bonds in it, or bonds within cyclic ring of carbon, or some other form of that. That's a very interesting thing that can do, that can how it can operate. But this little orange tree, which we fertilise, and it's really doing fantastic compared to other trees, which we thoroughly neglect. Any doubt about the cephalopods were colourblind seemed to evaporate when we finally got a look at the biology behind their vision. As scientists dissected the eyes of more cephalopod species, they kept finding only one type of light-detecting protein, and nothing like the cone cells used for colour vision. By the 80s, it was clear this was true for almost all species, a strong pointer that they can only see in black and white. That just deepened the mystery of cephalopod camouflaging capabilities. We know that the animals can match their skin tones to the colours of common environments. We also know they signal to one another by creating vivid patterns in their skins. That's risky behaviour with predators out to eat you. So the idea that you could see the pattern in grayscale seems absurd. Almost anyone who works in the field has a hard time believing it, says Dan Morse, University of California, Santa Barbara. Meanwhile, Morse and Halton's research teams have spent years demystifying the biomachinery of the cephalopod skin responsible for body patterning. It's a sophisticated system composed of at least two layers with sacks of pigments in the upper one and tunable structures for iridescence in the lower. Iridescence means colourfulness. It's pretty stupid. Yet Halton, who works in the Marine Biological University of Massachusetts, found himself returning to colour vision mystery and feeling there must be a missing something. Eventually he fell on an idea. If cephalopods don't see in colour with their eyes, perhaps they see with their skin. It wasn't as bizarre as it sounds. At the time, the researchers were starting to discover that some species have light-detecting proteins called opercins in their skin. These are the same family of molecules that detect lights in our eyes. Now, we recently discovered that they appear in human skins too. Well, there you go. Halton did a quick search of the proteins in the cuttlefish skins and found opercins. That 2010 discovery led to a whole new line of research. He teamed up with vision scientist Thomas Crowan in the University of Kingston, both in University of Maryland, hoping to find out where opercins were organised with, and whether they were connected to the skin's colour-changing apparatus. If cephalopods were reacting directly to colour through the connection of the skin without involving the brain, that might explain why they appeared incapable of consciously discriminating colour in behavioural studies. The team spent 5 years shining lights on squids and cuttlefish skin, uncovering opercins. Oh, gee. Here, there and everywhere. But proteins seemed disorganised and apparently lacked any connection with colour-changing systems. Researchers even found a slew of other molecules in the skin that involved in the processing of signals from light. But we never found anything that showed this photo system was doing anything, says Cronin, although we have no doubt that it was. At the same time, Todd Oakley and Desmond Ramirez, then at the University of California, Santa Barbara, were having more success with two spot octopuses. They looked pea-sized, and they took pea-sized pieces of skin and placed them under microscopes to see the pigment sacs. Then shone light on them. There was a little bit of delay and then a dramatic expansion. Certainly, the sacs opening is one way the cephalopods create colour. But although the experiment showed that the octopus's skin reacted to light, it didn't explain why or whether opacins were involved. Recently, a new idea has started ruffling tentacles. Ruffling feathers, ruffling tentacles. Biologist Alexander Stubbs at the University of California, Berkeley, and his father, Christopher Stubbs, at the Harvard physicist, turned to maths to solve the colorblindness problem. Their proposal first... Their proposal, first published in 2016, centers on the chromatic aberration, an effect where different wavelengths of colour of light come to focus at different distances from the lens. This happens in cameras and human eyes, but is maximised in off-centre pupils, which cephalopods have. Oh, there you go. They've got sort of half an eye and half a prism. Isn't that amazing? And so they would see colour changes in movement. The bear calculated that this provides a way for animals to distinguish colour with their eyes without the need for dedicated colour receptors molecules. Thinking of having to bring a different colours in and out of focus all the time, it's kind of the perception of the environment must be like. He says, it is just physically true that animals do this. Whether they use the information to discern colour is unclear. Alexander has mapped out experiments to test the idea, but needs a collaborator to carry them out. Well, yeah, obviously if you could put a something which changed the astigmatism, and then you could, it doesn't explain the colour blindness test. So yeah, they wouldn't respond to certain colours flashed at it, but they would respond to you'd be able to show them a colour blindness test and they'd be able to operate it. That's really interesting. Okay. Hamilton believes these experiments are worth doing. Alexander has mapped out experiments to test the idea but needs a collaborator to carry them out. Hamilton believes these experiments are worth doing, but he won't buy the idea until he sees more equations. There's not an ounce of data yet, he says. Meanwhile, the skin-sensing researchers are grappling with their own problems. One sticky point is that the opacins found in the cephalopod skin are the same as those in the eyes. Given the evidence that animals can't see colours with their eyes, it looks as though they would need some more than those same opacins to see with their skins. Houghton suggests that pigment sacs in the skins could act as crude filters for opacins, so the two components can detect the colour in tandem, or perhaps undiscovered opacins to the skin. Screening the genomes of the animal should give the answer. Okay, as always seems to be. Houghton's own institution, as it happens, is finishing the sequencing of the squid genome. Grant's adamant that opacins aren't redundant. Oh, they're doing something, he says. The fact that we didn't find them just means it's more obscure than we expected. Well, also, it'd be interesting where opacins were. Are they on the surface of the skin or under tentacles? You know, things which don't use them. Okay. Maybe the obscurity shouldn't be a surprise. Cephalopods have three hearts and multiple brains. Why should their senses be less alien than those and less psychology? This is the problem, is that they've got their gut going through the centre of their brain, which is an interesting thing. And the same goes for plenty of creatures that share their world. Some of their predators, such as diving birds, have colour vision, which makes a mockery of their own red-green-blue limitations. Although an octopus looks the same colour as its background when Hamilton peers through the camera, to a diving bird it might not. To get around this, Hamilton is developing a hyperspectral camera with 16 colour channels. No one's got a camera like this, he says, and with no way for humans to see all the colours, he's having to invent ways to analyse the results. If they confirm that octopuses disguise the effect of... Oh, God, that's sad. If they confirm octopus's disguise is effective in the eyes of its predators, that would snuff out any doubts that the truly color that truly do color match. And how do they do it? Like everything else about cephalopods, says Helen, the answer is going to be weird. Weird. Octopuses really fascinate me. They're so intelligent as well. It's another fascinating thing. Now here's an interview. An interview is read rather well. I'm 15 minutes in. Oh no. Treat AI like a wild animal. The time has come to look at artificial intelligence in a new way, says Iyad Arahan, or else we risk starting an algorithmic culture war. Sean O'Neill meets him. Artificial intelligence is becoming ever more powerful from deciding who gets hired to locking you into social media bubble and picking your, I love that, your next romantic partner. It's challenging society in countless ways. As the machines become ever smarter, who will ensure that their creators behave themselves? Yeah, Ryan's scalable cooperation group with MIT Media Lab is taking out the challenge. I like scalable cooperation. That's a lovely idea. Why do we need to keep tabs on algorithms? This question. We have a new kind of agent in the world. It's not animal or human. It's a machine. Today, only computer scientists explore the behavior of algorithms. My team is studying machine behavior as one would a human, animal, or corporation in the wild. Oh, God. Are you saying algorithms behave like animals? Animals? Animals are much more complicated, yet we have a long history of studying their behavior. It's the same for human psychology. We are far from understanding the brain, but we know a lot about human behavior. Even if we could see behind the corporate walls and access algorithmic source codes, we wouldn't understand the impact on society. The crucial thing is that algorithms act in the world, so we should look at the behavior in the world. I actually would agree with that. Algorithms already direct many aspects of our life. Aren't we a little late to the party? I'm not as pessimistic as that, but we do need to catch up because we are frequently taken by surprise as the consequences of algorithmic technologies. A good example is Facebook's news feed. It's just a ranking algorithm that serves news and posts from your friends. People thought it would usher in an era of democratic versification, connecting people with views outside their own. But what happened is exactly the opposite. There will be more unpleasant surprises, and my role is to try to shed light on these. You recently created a psychopathic AI. Why? The AI we created, dubbed Norman, sees violence and horror in every image it looks at. It's far from what human psychopath might be like, but we launched it with a popularized and important notion in machine learning. If an algorithm exists undesirable bias, the culprit is often the data used to train it. Norman was an evocative way to explain this point to a layperson. Look, I just think this is so much gobbledygook. I'll be pleasantly surprised when I actually get involved in it myself. Sorry guys, I'm just been eaten alive by mozzies. I don't know why there's mozzies. It's a cold day in Australia. What is appropriate behaviour for an AI system? Part of my work on machine ethics explores what people think is appropriate. What do humans expect a machine to do? And how do humans evaluate mistakes and moral violations by machines? I suppose philosophically I've got two ideas that you see a machine and a machine is, in fact you think a machine is the future, but your machine is the past because automation is people's mechanical conception of the future. So they automate a door because they believe people are going to walk through the door. So they've got a conceptualization of the future. So you are actually living, as we have literature, from the past, goes from the future. So we can listen to people in the past and they can get into our future, into our present. So to their machines that have been built in the past, popularity. We are living in people's mechanical conceptions, past mechanical conceptions of the future. Okay. Do people perceive machine mistakes differently from humans? Yes, they do. We make machines to be more systematic, so when the algorithm makes a mistake, we distrust it more than similar mistake by human. But critically, when there is a shared control between human and machine and the mishap occurs, people throw the blame on the human. I found this is by looking at autonomous vehicle accidents. Such as the self-driving car, Uber car, that hit the woman crossing the highway at night. Yes, with the Uber accident, people were very quickly to blame the human in the driver's seat. Is there such a thing as optimal ethical behaviour for a self-driving car? Consider Isaac Asimov's laws of robotics, designed to prevent robots harming humans. Think about AI as being dominated by the idea that once we find perfect rules of ethical conduct, machine can derive the correct behaviour in any given situation. That is a misguided approach. A moral machine project, my moral machine project has quizzed more than 4 million people on a wide range of road accident scenarios. Work suggests there can be no universal rules for automated vehicles. I would say this is sort of like a tropic. So what do you propose? I'm pushing for a negotiated social contract approach. As a society, we want to get along well, but to do it, we need a property rights, free speech, protection from violence, and so on. We need to think about machine ethics in the same way. People are happy in the abstract to endorse a car that might sacrifice its driver to save vulnerable pedestrians, but they certainly don't want to buy that car. If you leave it up to consumers, they will buy cars that prioritize them at all costs. And that's what every AI for itself approach could bring about. AI that caters only for the preferences of the customers who can afford them rather than the public good. That's actually a good point. I mean, I think he sounds sensible here. Are you confident that AI won't outpace society's ability to control it? It's very tempting to think AI as the monolithic entity that will somehow suddenly get too powerful to become unstoppable, like Skynet in the Terminator movies. That's a very unlikely scenario. More likely is what we have today. Different groups who struggle for financial success and power in a complex social process of competition and regulation. I think they will evolve to the next level of AI augmented, but they won't fundamentally change. We want AI to invent new drugs and power social media, but we also want it to protect the weak and make sure AI and those who control it don't amass too much power. That's a political process. We need to acknowledge that. What worries you most about where this technology is headed? Technology can be a force of good, but it can also be a force of, wait for it, evil. This goes all the way back to the invention of fire. I worry about politicization, cultural wars that are happening today about who runs society, whether we should have a progressive values or more conservative values, and how we negotiate these things. I worry that these fights will slip to algorithms. What are the risks of an algorithmic culture war? A politician eventually moves on, retires, or you can embrace them into a changing track. But algorithms that say allocate resources and influence hiring decisions are more entrenched and hidden. That becomes dangerous because government systems may get locked into a particular set of values and become unchangeable as society evolves. I would say, and I think people really do things. Okay. So when it comes to societies, one size should not fit all, so to speak. That's right. If I was born in Syria, but I lived for many years in the United Arab Emirates, Australia and the US, and I've seen various ways of running societies. He's been in Australia. These experiences have always coloured my reactions to this tendency of analytically minded people to pursue universal goals of ethics and AI. I'm very suspicious of that sort of thinking. But still, Which is weighs the best? Last, it's impossible to say. Ha ha ha. Bit strange, bit frightening. Okay, culture. Page 24. So, not page 24, it's page 44 of 6th of October. Attenborough makes an evolutionary leap. A fresh version of David Attenborough's best-known book may be light on climate change, but deserves to inspire another generation to cherish the living world. Life on Earth, the greatest story ever told, David Attenborough. It's amazing he's still producing it. When I saw the new edition of Life on Earth by David Attenborough on my desk, I felt an emotional twang. It's like seeing the cherished childhood friend again after decades on reaching the last chapter of a moving book and making you feel like cry. It's not too much to say that that the first edition of the published book published 40 years ago and the TV programs that accompanied it changed the lives of millions. I was one of them. As a child, I remember using the book to scare and entertain my younger sister and friends. I showed them a picture of a tasia, super cute, with gigantic eyes, and then flicked to a picture of an open-mouthed crocodile bursting out of a river to attack a wildebeest. But something about the book also touched us more deeply than that. It offered a window into a world of incredible life forms, more diverse than we could possibly imagine. Wonder that revelation stayed with him. I grew up behind a behavioural to become a behaviour ecologist studying animals. I must admit, the Pisonia tree, which is a bird killing, is an amazing thing to see. Years later, I was lucky enough to meet Attenborough, and I told him how he had inspired me as a kid. He noted joyfully he had heard the line many, many times. The latest edition of his classic book deserves to inspire another generation. With a revised text and new photographs, it's stunning and beautiful and wide-ranging work. The science, too, is thoroughly updated, and Attenborough acknowledges the help of Matthew Cobb, a zoologist at the University of Manchester, in rewriting the text. Cobb has done a superb job of covering an immense range of discoveries in intervening 40 years, from titaki, the species that represents the transition between fish and four-legged animals, to the Denisonians, the latest and extinct addition to the human family tree. Leafing through the books, there are extraordinary images of life. Take the bristlecone pine of Nevada, one of the longest lived organisms on Earth. It's humbling to think that the trees can live for more than 5,000 years. On another page, sand floats down the river like icing sugar as the Nile crocodile descends. Then is the amazing photograph of a fossil of a bird-like ground-dwelling dinosaur of China, some 150 million years old, and its feathers are clearly visible in the rock. Until quite recently, we didn't know that feathers could evolve for a reason other than flight, functioning primarily as insulation. Nor did we know that some dinosaurs survived the asteroid impact cataclysm of 66 million years ago and have become birds we see today. Oh, well. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting that you're teaching like that. The bird is heavily biased towards life forms visible to the naked eye, particularly the charismatic vertebrates, whose species can more easily relate to. An objective version would have been mostly about bacteria, among the first of our successful life forms on Earth, or archaea, I'd say. But wisely, we skip over the microbes and quickly focus on traditional stars of natural history. There's a wonderful shot of a sloth in Costa Rica, its fur green with algae, a miniature ecosystem itself. There it is. It's difficult to see the image and not endow the sloth with human qualities. This tendency to anthropomorphize becomes harder still to resist in the chapter about pirates. Here we see a female chimp using a stick to extract tasty termites from a mound. Her offspring under her arm, watching intently. There are magnificent silverback mountain gorillas, and an animal closely associated with Attenborough after his famous episode of Life on Earth TV series that featured him sitting amongst them. A small omission, the text in the new edition doesn't mention the species is now facing extinction, with around 1,000 animals left in the wild. Things change. Attenborough has become a fully-fledged legend, and his name is almost as big on the book cover as the title. If you read it, you can't help hearing the Attenborough voice. emotion I feel reading the new edition is covered not only by the nostalgia of my childhood, but also for the ecological disaster of climate change that has unfolded since its first appearance. In the late 1970s, a book called Life on Earth should be published purely as a celebration of extraordinary power of evolution, unashamedly admiring to inspire wonder about the natural world. The edition is still mostly about that, the work of old school natural history. Only in the fourth paragraph from the end is climate change mentioned, and then, slightly weirdly, when we read that seas are warming as a consequence of climate changes we've caused. Attenborough's recent Blue Planet 2 ended with a call for oceans to be cleared of plastic pollutions. As a problem gets mentioned here too, but the role of climate change in threatening large amounts of life on Earth is conspicuously absent. The desperate extinction rate and the fact that many scientists consider that we have entered a new geological epoch dominated by human activity, termed the Anthropocene, is now mentioned. Epilogue talks about extinctions of the passenger pigeon, the most numerous bird in history, and the dinosaurs, but not ones we're now causing. I think the epilogue should have laid out this out clearly. Attenborough did not mention climate change in his TV series for many years, saying he was cautious about crying wolf until science was in. But in the last decade or so, he's addressed the problem clearly. And it's a shame he didn't do it in the same update of his most famous book. That quibble aside, the breadth of natural history covered in the book is extraordinary, and mesmerising for the fact that Attenborough and his advisor Cobb could be congratulated. Life on Earth is still breathtakingly rich, and we would know far more less about it if it were not for Attenborough, his wonderful skills of communication over the years. Our cultural and scientific lives would be poor without him. He's got this beautiful way of saying in terms of, he says quietly, and he says, and it's sort of like, it's scripted with the birds and animals beginning to act as behaviour. So it's a beautiful way of going here. Okay, page 32 minutes in, and page 46, and this looks to be about breastfeeding. The Shape of Motherhood, an exploration of the critical issues women face as new mothers, is timely, says Linda Geddes. Space and Politics of Motherhood by Kate Boyer. Social Experiences of Breastfeeding, Building the Bridges Between Research and Policy and Practice, edited by Sally Dowling and David Ponton and Kate Boyer. It's almost two decades since the UK's National Health Service launched its Breast is Best slogan. It's yet despite campaigns and relatively generous maternity leaves, the number of mothers who breastfeed after 12 months in UK is still less than 1%, one of the world's lowest rates. The figures jumped out at Kate Boyer when she moved to the UK from the US in 2008, giving birth to Jake 9 months later. Boyer, a mother, a human geographer at Cardiff University, wondered if the geographic variation in parenting cultures might influence their decisions-making more than people believed, and helped explain why some policies targeting new mothers succeeded while others failed. Since then, Boyer has crawled over parenting blogs, forums and policy texts, and surveyed the interviews of new mothers in London and South East England. Her decision to concentrate on women when many men share childhood is pragmatic. Women still do most of the care, and only women perform the key aspect of parenting, breastfeeding. The result is Spaces and Politics of Motherhood, looking at how physical and cultural spaces that women inhabit shape the mothers they become. The book is fascinating, challenging, asking us to see parenthood through the new lens. It tackles the difficulties of mobility of the baby, for example, and how that influences journeys mothers make, in turn affecting how they interact with others. Take the unwieldy assemblages of mothers, babies and prams. Not only is it difficult to physically get from A to B, many of Boyer's new mothers describe their anxiety epitomised by the possibility of being trapped in a closed public space with a screaming baby. All this has implications for policymakers because public reactions can be off-putting, she says, and serve as a disincentive to journeying outside the home. The bulk of the book focuses on breastfeeding, which Boyer says is far less a choice than a health campaign makes out. Not all women can afford to sit in a warm, inviting, breast-friendly cafe. Most half of the interviewees had some kind of negative experience from people making tutting noises and being glared at. And she also highlights experiences of pain while breastfeeding and perceived poor milk flow, for which women felt unprepared and some saw their bodies working against them. Its theme is picked up in Social Experiences of Breastfeeding, which Boyer co-edited, drawing on seminars funded by the UK Economic and Social Research Council. The authors seek to bridge the gap between professionals keen to increase breastfeeding rates and the women actually doing it. I found the chapter by Dawn Lemming, a psychologist at the University of Hunterfield, very insightful. Many new mothers say they feel guilty for not breastfeeding, but less recognised, arguably more destructive, the emotional is shame. As Lemming writes, not only can women feel shame for breastfeeding, they can also be shamed for not breastfeeding. Although there is an overlap between the emotions, shame can involve negative judgment about the whole person, leaving the woman feeling powerless and at greater risk of depression, writes Lemming. Quote, just because breastfeeding is a natural doesn't mean that it's obvious what to do, is the message that needs promoting, she adds. Or women will go on seeing breastfeeding problems as a personal shortcomings. Parenting books, often standing as a role model for mothers, can create idealised expectations and undermine their resolve to breastfeed. In other chapters, Amy Brand, a health researcher at Swansea University, shared her work on parenting book that promotes strict routines. Only 20% of mothers manage to comply, the failure linked to increased anxiety and depression. Training support to fix all this won't come cheap, and neither book considers the cost of economic benefits of the outlay. Even so, there is real food for thought. After all, reaching the health benefits of practices like breastfeeding is fine. Without studying the social forces shaping its change seems doomed. Page 52, letters, the editor's pick. War is a fairly recent part of human history. Kenneth Payne offers an important and illuminating discussion on the problem of artificial intelligence presents in the military sphere. He opens by stating, archaeological and ethnographical evidence suggests that warfare among our hunter-gatherers ancestors was common. The claim has been promulgated by some high-profile writers recently, but not everyone agrees. For example, in the 2013 War, Peace and Human Nature, The Convergence of Evolutionary and Cultural Views, a review of the issue by archaeologists, anthropologists, evolutionary biologists, primatologists, neuroscientists, physiologists and social scientists drew the opposite conclusion. They said archaeological evidence revealed war is a relatively recent phenomenon emerging from the Neolithic period onwards. We have much to learn about what drives societies to fight, but the idea that war is inherent to human nature relies more on cherry-picking the data, support cultural bias than any objective view of evidence. Sense of Self in Science, Shakespeare and Trout, by Steve Brewer, a letter from St. Ives, Cornwall, UK. Sophia Delaney describes self-awareness as an illusion, and on your cover, you call it a delusion. What wasn't discussed was the power to turn the whole world as we view it into illusions by the process of informing abstract concepts and ideas about it. By developing, interconnecting these abstractions, we have produced various sciences. Through them, we have achieved enormous power over ourselves and our natural worlds. Self-awareness may yield this great power, but it also results in a broader illusion held by many that this world of abstraction is more real than the natural one. This world of concepts, individuals have become just another concept, and so dehumanized. Recognizing this is as the most dangerous delusion may help defend our humanity. Beautiful set of thoughts, but people can't really, a delusion of delusions. Illusions is beautiful. By Kim Brody, Staten Island, New York. My self-awareness thoroughly enjoyed Delvina's article. Her conclusion, however, seems regulated human self-awareness to be a byproduct of the humming of a neural engine, not essentially different from, for instance, the 3D echolocation modelling that goes on in a bat's brain. And if self-awareness doesn't require a higher order of consciousness but a running simulation in our brains, consciousness may not necessarily have a function. This line of thinking reminds me of William James's 1890 Principles of Psychology, in which he argues that we are fully understood if we fully understood Shakespeare's nervous system, and we could account for every word and alteration of the manuscript to Hamlet without having to acknowledge the existence of thoughts of Shakespeare's mind. Having reduced the arguments to absurdity, James moves on to considered consciousness. Another, Daniel Hackett, London, UK. Delvini suggests self-awareness is an extension of the challenge of dealing with the minds of others, prey, competitors, and members of your social group. Territoriality should not be underestimated as an example of such a challenge. If you put two trout into a small tank, they would skirmish. The loser will change to a dark colour and sulk at the bottom. It knows it has been beaten and does not try it on until the top trout goes away. It may not... that's interesting. It may not have a demonstrable "this is me" mode, but surely this is more where individualization starts. This kind of awareness of one's situation. Oh, good on you, Guy Cox. He's a great writer. I know Guy Cox. I hope he is. Jeffrey Hart suggests that stratum of the plastogramic might geologically delineate the atropine, or I prefer to call it the plasticine epoch. Plastic persists long enough to cause havoc in our oceans, but will not withstand the geological heat and pressures of geological timescales. Plastics are most commonly carbon and hydrogen, and ultimately could be converted to coal and oil. Maybe a new civilization, millions of years since, will mine these starts a whole cycle over again. Defining moment of... I think that's not really necessary. That's a nice thought, but it's not necessarily true. Defining moment for global scale renewables. From Paul Van Lodswell, Devon, UK. Michael Laplage discussed the potential of very large-scale desert solar wind farms to increase the local rainfall and hence vegetation. And the UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres declared on the 10th of September that we are at the defining moment for avoiding runaway climate change. It seems we have a critical need and opportunity for a global project, led perhaps by the UN and the World Bank, to make global-scale investment in a very, very large-scale desert-based solar and wind farms. I'm sure there are many pensions and other investment funds looking for this securely and responsibly, but we're at present of divesting from oil, gas, and other destructive pollution sectors. Perhaps this will tempt them. Such schemes would be bigger than any energy projects yet undertaken. Many countries would have to be involved in the science and engineering, and the projects must balance the interests of the communities and contractors, manufacturers, investors, governments, and other potential beneficiaries or losers, I'd say. What is the true impact of electric cars? Alice Klein reports hydrogen-powered cars competing with electric cars on environmental grounds, questions if either are green. Say an electric car's batteries are charged with electricity from a gas-fired power station with a carbon footprint of 400 grams per kilowatt hour. Say losses in transmission are 14% and the car uses 0.5 watts per kilometer. The carbon dioxide emission is about 70 grams per kilometer. Some petrol-powered carbon cars have emissions at this level. If coal is used instead of gas, the electric car emits more CO2. The figures for hydrogen cars are similar, unless the hydrogen is made only using renewable electricity. This will remain true until existing electricity demand has been satisfied by low carbon generation, as there is some spare capacity. When do we think this is going to happen? Never, unless we focus on the real issues: more solar panels, more wind, and maybe nuclear power, I would say. At present, the UK government gets around $34 billion in fuel duty from vehicle tax on road transportation. The incentive to move to electric includes little or no vehicle tax on them, and recharging at home bearing a 5% domestic tax, a lot less than the tax rate levied on petrol and diesel. A lot of electric vehicles go on the road, and the government stands to lose a considerable amount of tax. So, what are the plans for the later increasing revenue from electric vehicles to bring the future cost of electric motoring in line with the present cost of petrol and diesel, where the greatest part of the cost is fuel tax? The cost of on-street recharging could include electric fuel tax. Will charging at home require a separate smart metering to levy an e-fuel charging, including tax? Acoustic levitation might get water from desert air. That's an interesting thing. By Yorks Volks Manifolds, Country Durham, UK. Ivan Ye reports on using sound pressure to create a bubble in levitating droplets. 5 years ago, Jacob Aron described a similar levitation using sound, creating a standing wave in which gravitational and acoustic waves cancel. Levitated objects could be removed along a line where the forces cancel out and mix by varying the strength of the sound waves. Maybe this could become more than a clever trick. Around the third Earth's land area is desert. In many places, the only fresh water is collected by adapted plants, and the morning mists blow in the sea. There have been many suggestions over the years how to trap soils of fresh water for human use. Might it be possible to set up a high-frequency acoustic standing wave between an emitter and reflector to move the water droplets along the fold downwards collected to the base of the device? I would say not. Isn't that amazing? Okay, we have created conditions for superbugs. I read with interest Michael Lepage's account of the science waging war attrition with evolution. We seem to forget that survival depends on Mother Nature's ability to bounce back after the terrible things we keep doing to her. Once we've killed the soil biome with the chemicals, we'll have no other option but to farm chemically. We are removing the natural balance, and that's why we have to continually compensate with yet more chemicals. Pharmaceuticals and agrochemical companies stand to gain, destroy the natural fertility of the soil, and we are dependent on artificial fertilizers, the manufacture and use of which worsens other problems that of greenhouse gas emissions. We've created the conditions for superbugs, both insects and bacterial, in monocultures, in our guts and in the soil, in the fields, in the forests and the hospitals, intensive farming, even the oceans, that create the conditions where things we fear most can thrive conveniently. These conditions also require us to spend more and more on chemical intervention, both mechanically and medically and agriculturally. Fuming on planes, trains, and maybe latrines. Lara Williams' comment on vaping on public transport reminded me of conversations back when smoking was allowed on buses, trains and aeroplanes. The person in the seat next to you might ask, do you mind if I smoke? And perhaps add, just a bad habit, I can't shake it. The appropriate reply was, no, not at all, do you mind if I fart? It's just a habit, I can't seem to shake it. So that's a lovely story. Last word. The aftermath of a horrendous Grenfell Tower disaster in London last year, I'd like to know why rescuing trapped individuals appears beyond our present capabilities. Why we can't construct ladders that will reach people trapped in tall buildings? Why can't all towers have nets that are deployed around the base to catch those willing to jump? Especially if I combined with occupants being provided with inflatable suits to cushion their falls. Why can't helicopters be deployed to rescue from windows and blankets? Why aren't all occupants in high-rise apartments given the chance to escape by sliding down wires or slides? Why are such suggestions considered outlandish? The reason most are considered outlandish is that few such ideas could work. Nets around towers would be vandal-prone and need a lot of maintenance to ensure they were ready for the emergency. Unskilled people falling more than a few metres into nets could break their necks. Inflatable clothing or not. Nor can jumpers rapidly vacate a net before hundreds of people would evacuate. Many would die landing on each other. Fire escapes are more useful. Forget helicopters unless an undamaged accessible helipad is on the building. But it would take many helicopters to evacuate a large building. Some ideas might be worth developing. Suitable fire escape parachutes could ease the victims down capable down cables. Individual fire escape reels could be designed to unwind at a controlled speed to low occupants to the ground, or something could be based on a zip line. Fire escape slides on or ladders deployable externally from the top of a building might work, but deploying them in emergencies would be a challenge. Rationally designed lifts are probably the best escape route, while the building remains intact, but current design standards means most lifts are not useful in emergencies. I prefer the idea of those who are trapped jumping into inflatable funnels that rise a few hundred metres deployed and steered from rescue vehicles. Controlled airfoils and baffles into the funnel would avoid dangerous speeds and rescued subjects could be extracted at the bottom. The longer the ladder is, the stronger the heavier it needs to be. This would make ladders capable of high-ride rescues hard to maneuver in narrow city streets. Limited access to the area in the base of Grenfell Tower made it much harder for the London Fire Brigade to set up normal appliances. As for nets, in order to slow someone's descent gently enough to avoid fatal injuries, they would need to be suspended high off the ground. This would make it tricky to set them up quickly. They would also potentially get in the way of firefighters. Inflatable suits would need to be very bulky to make a difference and would slow down people trying to escape. Flying helicopters next to buildings is dangerous at the best of times, especially if the building is on fire and debris are falling. Zip wires have some merit, but are slow, heavy and need training to set up, not to mention suitable anchor points. Along with size, they have their uses in situations where the risk of fire is relatively high. Boeing has them at space launch sites, for instance. I suspect that most such ideas are thought outlandish for tower blocks because the strategy of containing a fire within a single flat is cheaper, easier, and usually very effective. There are better solutions than nets and wires and so on. By all means, use cladding to make buildings look prettier, but use non-inflatable materials. Design a building to resist fire, avoiding cavities through which it can spread, install sprinklers and pressurize the air and stair lift shafts to keep smoke at bay, and hence provide a safe exit path where temperatures, visibility and electricity is kept within safe limits and long enough for people to escape. You could include a bridge to an adjacent tall building. Allow for safe refuges to give time for fire brigade to rescue the occupants, such as installing entrance doors to flats that are best at least resist fire for 15 minutes. And finally, towers should have a means of warning the occupants of the emergency evacuation. Next, that was by Terence Hollingworth of Ballyant, France. During my 32 years in fire and rescue service, I have been to numerous fires and flats, and fires that have never spread beyond the flat where it started. This is how buildings must be designed. However, for policy advising residents in other flats to stay put during the fire, to be reliable, design and maintenance of the fire-resisting components and fire doors is vital. As for outlandish ideas, in the Victorian period, there was numerous patents for self-rescue devices to use in a building fire. One I recall was a cord concealed in a gentleman's belt, which could be used to escape down the outside of a building.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.